Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today, part two of What's on Your Home Bookshelf with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And author Peter Abrahams. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Mindy. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
So you have such large bookshelves, we have to do a second show on this.
Exactly. And also, it's been really interesting how just in a month, my reading habits have sort of changed dramatically and turned into listening habits rather than reading habits.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know about you, Peter, how well you're doing reading right now. I find it much, well, it's getting better. I will say it's getting better. In fact, it seemed like this week I was able to actually, you know, spend more than 5 minutes reading the book. But it's been hard. It's been hard to read. So
you've been preferring audio, is that?
That is correct. I've been listening to, and I never listened to audiobooks normally, but I have discovered that they can be really relaxing. And, of course, you know, with Libby, with the library's collection, I don't even have to buy them. I can just check them out of the library, which is great. And although there is one that it looks like I'm going to have to purchase at some point. And after talking about it, I know I'm going to have to purchase it because everyone's going to want to listen to it because of the magic that it can do. Would you like to hear about this?
Yes, I would love to hear about this.
Well, it turns out, so I've been, as many people probably have been, having trouble sleeping, and that's been true since this started. And so I was thinking about, you know, what could I listen to? And I remembered back in the distant past when I'd also been having trouble sleeping, that the one thing that could put me to sleep in about, I don't know, 5 to 10 minutes was the sound of Jeremy Irons' voice. Now, for those of you who don't know who Jeremy Irons is, he is an actor, and he is also was in a television series that was on many, many years ago called Brideshead Revisited. And it was actually one of the first big BBC productions of a television series. It was many episodes long, and this is pre-internet. Everybody was gripped by it. You had to watch it at the time it was on. You couldn't wait for it to be on YouTube. And it was a huge success. And I watched that, and I then read Brideshead Revisited, and then most recently I discovered that Brideshead Revisited has been put up on Libby and is narrated by Jeremy Irons. And I tell you, I have yet to get to the end of the book. I've barely gotten to the end of chapter two because every time I listen, his voice, there is something so magical about his voice. And Dan Tridle was kind enough to find a clip from the very beginning of the book. So you too can hear a few seconds of Jeremy Irons' voice.
All right, let's take a listen.
Here, love had died between me and the army. Here the tram lines ended, so that men returning fuddled from Glasgow could doze in their seats until roused by their journey's end. There was some way to go from the tram stop to the army gates, quarter of a mile in which they could button their blouses and straighten their caps before passing the guardroom, quarter of a mile in which concrete gave place to grass at the road's edge. This was the extreme limit of the city. Here the close, homogeneous territory of housing estates and cinemas ended, and the hinterland began.
I don't know, I'm hearing Scar from the Lion King.
Well, I'm hearing, have you ever seen a movie called Margin Call?
No.
I have not.
Oh, he's just superb in that. And he plays kind of a somewhat villainous person, but complex at the same time. And his voice is, I mean, it is, as you say, it's just magical.
Yeah.
Interesting that you bring up Brideshead Revisited. I was going to do an Evelyn Waugh pick one, but it didn't make my list. But since you brought up Brideshead Revisited, anyone who likes Evelyn Waugh should also try Handful of Dust.
Ah, yes, yes.
Fantastic book.
Well, and may I also mention that as it happens, Philip Horror has been doing this online thing about, he's been, well, not he alone, but he and several people have been putting together this thing called the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, Big Read, which every day they've been publishing a little bit publishing. I'm not sure that's even the right word. They have been putting up on Twitter, or you can go to their webpage, but little bits of the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, Big Read. And Philip is spends a lot of time in Provincetown, is a good friend of Dennis Minsky's, and has done a lot of movies and books on whales. But this Rime of the Ancient Mariner, as it happens, the first reader is Jeremy Irons. And I was I'm going to And he has, I mean, there are many, many fabulous voices in that particular thing. But yeah, Jeremy Irons.
Yeah. And, Jill, and, I have to talk about that Libby app, because I don't know that everybody knows about that. And that is a fantastic app. You can connect to many libraries with that app. And I have found, you know, I don't listen to a lot of audiobooks, but when my uncle is here, whose vision is not so great, we do a lot of those. And it really depends on the reader. Some of them are fantastic, and some not so much.
That is very, very, very true. And I have to say, you know, the library has been closed. The building has been closed. As I like to say, the building has been closed, but the library is still open. And Libby is one of the ways the library is open. And we've been answering phones at the Falmouth Public Library from 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, as if we were really open, which we are on, in some level. And I swear every day there's at least one call. How do I download Libby? How do I get to? And it's great. I mean, so many people are discovering Libby because they're at home and they want to hear something or read something. I mean, they're also not only audio, but also just books you can read. So if you just want to read Brideshead Revisited, you can do that as well.
Okay, and if they have trouble downloading, you'll help them on the phone.
That's right. We do it every day.
Yeah, that's great. All right, Peter, what's your first book?
Well, before I even get to that, today we're having total digressions, but which suits the mood.
Doesn't it?
while we're giving shout-outs to, you know, readers of audiobooks, I'd like to mention Jim Frangione, who is originally from Barnsley, lives in Western Mass, and he does a lot of his audio. What he does is great. He's just a terrific narrator of books on tape. And I'm not just saying that because he does my Chet and Bernie series, which he does so beautifully, because often when you're a writer and you know, and the audio books come, often you think, well, it's just missing, you know, because you have your own little image in your mind of how it's supposed to be. Anyway, I've learned things about the characters from listening to how he does it.
And isn't that interesting? And since you mentioned Spencer Quinn's books, which are the Chet and Bernie series, you got a nice shout out from Stephen King on your latest book.
Well, the book's not out yet, but yes. Thank you.
He says,
comes out in July.
Yeah, he says, I've been a Chet and Bernie fan from the start, and this is the best one yet. Suspenseful, laugh out loud, funny in places, and surprisingly tender. This is without a doubt the most original mystery series currently available. Not a bad review.
Pretty
from
good,
Mr.
Peter.
King.
Pretty good.
thank you. Thanks.
Well, and I actually have a question for you as an author, which is, do you have any say over who's going to narrate your book?
No. Yes and no. I have had, and so when I wrote that children's series Bowser and Birdie, which was also a dog narrated thing, but for kids, they asked me if I had any preference, and I mentioned Jim, and so he ended up doing that. It's not like I have a formal, you know, contract where it's up and down, but sometimes I'm included in the conversation.
All right. Now to your first book.
Now to my first book, which is going to sound very dry after all this. In fact, maybe I shouldn't even do it, but it's Farnsworth's Classical English Style. So Ward Farnsworth is the dean of the University of Texas Law School, and he wrote a book called Classical English Rhetoric, and then called another one called Classical English Metaphor, and now this is Classical English Style. And I guess it's a pushback against, in a lot of these advice on how to write books, clarity and efficiency are what's being stressed nowadays. And he is he's interested in that, but he also wants to see if you can get power into your writing. And I think it's very good on that. He uses tons of quotations. Lincoln, Churchill, King James, Bible, Shakespeare, and he's also very good on Saxon words, you know, the Anglo-Saxon words and the Latinate words and how to mix them, and he believes in the Saxon ending, where the Saxon-type words coming at the end of the sentence give it much more of a punch. I don't know if people know what I mean, what he means by Saxon and Latinate, but in the English language, we're so lucky that, you know, we have these various streams coming in, the most important being Latin and the Anglo-Saxon. So we have two words or sometimes three for everything. So an example would be regal, royal, kingly. Regal is Latin, royal is French Latin, and kingly is the Saxon. And you see kind of the power and simplicity of that kingly and all that. Anyway, here's an example that of how he uses what you call the Saxon end, what he calls the Saxon ending. And this is Churchill. The truth is incontrovertible. Panic may resent it. Ignorance may deride it. Malice may distort it. But there it is. So you see that little ending, but there it is, the Saxon. I also learned in this book about Anna Kaluthin. Does that ring a bell with either of you?
No.
It does not.
Okay. I've never heard of it before. So it comes from Greek, an meaning not, and akaluthos meaning following. And I guess that's where we get the word acolyte from. So it's a grammatical form where there's a change in grammatical structure in mid-sentence. And I realized that with the Chet and Bernie books where Chet, the dog, narrates the series. He's not a talking dog. Chet uses Anna Kaluthin all the time. So here would be an example. Like, I'm just making this up, but something like this. The secret of the universe came to me, and for the first time I realized, uh-oh, what the heck was that? Okay, that's Anna Kaluthin. And, I mean, Chet thinks that way all the time, but he and I just didn't know it was a fantasy. So Farnsworth's Classical English Style is a pretty entertaining and short book. It's only 145 pages, you know, about how to write, not just clearly, but with a bit of oomph in your prose.
I love it. Jill?
Another thing I have been listening to, because, again, I am able to listen more than anything, and this is a series, although I have to say, these come out every day, every weekday, like Monday through Friday, there's one of these conversations, and it's called The Quarantine Tapes, and started because of the quarantine. It eventually, apparently, originally it was supposed to be an interview series with a whole bunch of people in the room, and the first one, you hear this whole audience, and you're thinking, what's happening? How can there be an audience? Well, there is an audience in that one because it was pre-pandemic, and after that, all of them are done by telephone, and they're done by a fellow who now lives in Los Angeles. For a long time, he worked at the New York Public Library, which is where I first got to know him, but his name is Paul Holdengraber, and he created this series along with a radio station in L.A., and they basically do interviews one a day, and as an article described it, and with the world turning upside down and inward and everything changing every moment and all of us trying to figure out what it means, what to do, and what's to come, all while being separated just when we need each other the most, catching up with people on the phone suddenly seemed like a good idea again, maybe the only idea. And the radio station is called Dub Lab, and they normally apparently play music in LA, but they've been playing these interviews once a day. And of course, what happens when you're listening to these interviews is you're thinking, I've never heard of that author. I have to buy that book. So and you're trying to support your local booksellers, right? So while I had so many books already in the house, I've discovered that I now have a whole new pile of books, all of which have been purchased online from local booksellers. In order to keep up with everything I'm listening to. And one of the most interesting interviews, and I'll tell it, was with this fellow who everybody other than me apparently knows. I honestly somehow missed him, and that's one of the things I love about this series of conversations. There are lots of them that are with people I had never heard of before and then fall in love with after listening to their interviews. And Saul Williams was one of those people. And I wrote when I tweeted about this when I first listened to it, and what I said was, every conversation Holden Graber has in his quarantine tape series is in some way fascinating, but this talk with Saul Williams is a revelation, a voice of reason in the madness. Take the time, listen to this. And you don't even need to really, I mean, you should listen to this. It's a great interview, but I then got one of his books, two of his books, in fact, and it is just the books themselves are really fascinating. His history is really fascinating. He spent a lot of time living in France, and he came back to America with a changed vision. And he also this book also has these wonderful poems that he's written, and one of the ones I most love was about his daughter, and when he asked her to clean up her room. And here's it's not long. Here's the poem. It's very funny. Father begins. Oh, and it's called Paid Advertisement 1. Father begins, I asked her to clean up her room. She said, I'm not a slave. Nah, duh, I said, because if you were with that attitude, you'd be dead. No, I would be like Harriet Tubman or Sojourner Truth. And in honor of Black History Month, I won't clean up my room. In honor of the maids who work long hours for little or no pay, who cleaned and cleaned and cleaned and cleaned, I won't clean up today. Well, you sure do know your history, I said. Girl, you make me proud. And in honor of your mixed ancestry, you should clean the house. So it's just a silly poem about cleaning the house, but it's also all about history and African-American history and how kids do things when they're home and how they interact with their parents. Anyway, the whole book is just full of fascinating poems, and again, his biographical history. He is many things. He is not just a poet. He is a rapper. He has written 4 books of poetry. He's recorded 5 albums. He's been a major influence on modern poetry, and I had never heard of him until I listened to the conversation on the quarantine tapes. So I highly recommend both the quarantine tapes and Saul Williams.
You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show. We're talking about books on our home bookshelves. What are you reading? 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us this morning is Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Peter Abrahams. And Peter, what is on your list next?
Well, just apropos of what Jill was saying about having trouble sleeping, I've always been and still am a great sleeper. Before I go to sleep, I always am reading some kind of book, not on a screen, just, you know, an actual physical book. So one of the things in this time, I kind of find it nice to go back, way back in time and read about, you know, long ago things. And one book I've really enjoyed is called Chaucer's Tale. Road 1386 and the Road to Canterbury. So this is about Geoffrey Chaucer, not his whole life. It's not a full biography or anything like that. And it's really not an analysis of the Canterbury Tales either. It's about 1386 and his life in that year. So I knew very little about his actual life. I mean, in college, I was forced to do the Canterbury Tales, which we were allowed to do in modern English. And reading this book, where there's some quotes in the language he wrote them in, I realized I should have taken the time to learn how to read that. It's not that hard, and it's really interesting. Anyway, I knew nothing about it. He was like a minor gentry kind of figure, and he married up, and everything was, he was always on a kind of edge of insecurity, and that, so he was a minor court figure for a while, and then that didn't last, and he became the controller of the wool custom. That meant the wool trade. And England was all about the wool trade then. And so the guys who actually controlled the wool trade, he had to make sure that their paperwork was right for taxation. So it was totally corrupt. He was under huge pressure. And there were all these schemers and powerful people. And he was just this little guy who at night, with telling very few people, wrote poetry. So finally in 1386, he lived in a in, you know, for free in this tower in the wall around London called Aldgate Tower. And he lived there for about 10 years, and then all of a sudden he was booted out in 1386. And he had no job, and he went down into Kent, and that's when he wrote Canterbury Tales. And this, some of the things from his, okay, he's one of the greatest writers in English, and this is what the writer Paul Strome has to say about him. From our vantage point, we might suppose that his literary reputation would have bought him some time and temporary credit. From a young age and throughout all previous changes of fortune, Chaucer had resolutely pursued his literary aims. By 1386, he had written more than half of his poetry, a body of work already sufficient to establish him as the greatest English author before Shakespeare. Why then, in his time of trouble, didn't doors fly open for him, or admirers vie to provide him with support and succor? In fact, he was not yet a celebrated writer. His literary successes had been confined to a small and appreciative circle rather than shared by a more general literary public. He wrote not for hire or on command, or most certainly prior to 1386 for fame, but simply because he wanted to. He had not made and would never make a penny from his verse. So here's this sort of rings like a death knell in the heart of every writer.
Yeah.
It sort of sums up the business so beautifully. But he, at the very end, he began to turn himself into something that hadn't been in the English language before, and that was a professional writer writing for the public, which is what he did with Canterbury Tales. Mm-hmm. Anyway, a very interesting Chaucer's Tale, a very interesting voyage way, way back in time, and this great man who was not appreciated except by really probably a dozen people during his lifetime.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Thanks for that. Let's talk to Sue, who's giving us a call from Dennisport. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Mindy. Thank you for this joyful show today. It's true that readers have joy in their heart, I think. I am reading Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility. And I'm just amazed at the analysis of the characters which Jane Austen put into her imaginary work. You know, it's pre-Freudian, but it really hits the mark. So that's what I'm doing. I'm enjoying Sense and Sensibility. Yeah. And then I'll go through the whole genre because I have all her books. So that's wonderful to be able to do.
Yes, absolutely. And Jane Austen certainly has quite a following. Jill, I imagine you hear from lots of Jane Austen fans looking for her work.
Yes, and I think again, it's one of those authors who you go back to again and again, and does give a certain sense of comfort because even if you're reading her for the first time, it's just taking you into this other world. And I think right now, anything that takes you into mm-hmm. another world is a really wonderful thing. It's really,
yes, very welcome thing.
It can
thing.
Really
yes.
take you away from all of it. And that is the amazing thing about reading, is that it just takes you elsewhere.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think a lot of us are looking for distractions right now, and Jane Austen is a great way to get distracted. Sue, thanks for sharing that. And we have Mary giving us a call from Provincetown. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have two for you.
Okay.
One is by Anthony Mara, and it's, A Constellation of Vital Phenomena. It's about 10 or 15 years old, and I've read it twice.
Wow.
I don't read books twice, only like 100 years of solitude about every 10 years I read that. But this is about Chechnya, and I think it was on the bestseller list. It's incredibly deep, and you'll completely get lost.
All right, what's the name
and
of it again, Mary?
A Constellation of Vital Phenomena.
Okay.
And his name is Anthony Mara. It's incredible. It's a real page turner, beautifully written. I'm getting a little feedback on my phone, so I'll just tell you this other one really quick that I am about to get into again. It's by Michael Cunningham, and it's called By Nightfall. And it's incredibly beautiful, written. It's about the art business in New York and told through a man who's a gallery owner, told through his eyes. And it's the complexity of his life and the insanity of the business. It's, again, because it's Michael Cunningham, beautifully written. And I don't recall it got huge amounts of, people that have spoken to about it haven't heard about it, even though he's very popular. But this one's a gem.
All right. That's By Nightfall, Michael Cunningham. Mary, thanks for sharing those two books. That's great. We'll put that on our list. By the way, you don't need to be jotting these down. If you're missing some of the books, we will have a link later today to all of the books that we talk about on the book show this morning. So, Jill, what is next on your list?
Well, what's next on my list is something that I actually had requested at one point from a publisher, because when I heard what the title of it was, I was like, I have to have this copy of this book before it reaches the public, and somehow we have to interview this author at some point. And the reason I thought we should interview this person at some point is because the title of the book is The Cape Cod Bicycle War and Other Stories by Billy Cahora. And I had never heard of Billy Cahora before. He lives now in England. This was published by Ohio University Press. And he writes about Kenya. However, this one story, I just have to read the first couple sentences, because I think it opens our eyes, as stories will, to what's right around us that we may not have noticed. And this begins with a section called The Bicycles. We came to Orleans, Cape Cod, that winter after 9/11 to work at the local Wendy's. Students from Eastern Europe, Latin America, and Africa, new to America and dorming at the Wendy's house. Juanita Gomez and Carmela Dos Santos from Bogota moved into the house, and because they were there, first took over the TV. Then Juanita made the green Schwinn with the large tires and low-slung seat hers. Carmela chose the red chopper with the tall front handlebars and front small wheel. Kudzai Farai, a Shona boy who had already been around the year before in some sort of self-exile from Zimbabwe, kept the large mountain Schwinn. Yoho da Silva from São Paulo chose a large traditional bicycle, heavy as a farm horse, that Giorgio Moldovanu from Moldavia called a Soviet worker's bicycle. And it goes on and on and on and describes all of their bicycles and what they're doing on Cape Cod in the middle of the winter. And we see these kids. We see these kids all the time, but we don't know a lot about them necessarily. And so I think what I loved about this story was it was just this little bitty window into who they are. And this summer, I don't think we'll be seeing them, because I think we're going to, because of the world in which we now live. So it's nice to go back. And I know from when I first moved to Falmouth, you would see these influxes of children. When it started, everybody was from Ireland, like everyone working summer jobs was from Ireland, but that's changed over the years. And this year it looks like it will be anybody who's living in town will be working. So it's a really interesting collection of stories. It's called The Cape Cod Bicycle War by Billy Cahora.
All right. And let's talk to Marjorie, who's calling from East Falmouth. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi there. I just went on a wonderful train journey into the heart of Russia. The book is called Midnight in Siberia, and it's written by David Green, who is a host of NPR's Morning Edition. Mm-hmm. And it's an absolutely wonderful book about a country that I knew very little about and was always curious.
Wonderful. Midnight in Siberia, David Green. Yeah. Okay. Marjorie, thank you for that. Thanks for sharing. We'll add that to our list. 866-999-4626 if you'd like to add a book to our list. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Peter, what have you got next?
Well, now that this wasn't going to be what I had next, but since Jill mentioned bicycling, I do have a bicycle book to recommend. We're very lucky here on Cape Cod because there are these trails, especially the Shining Sea Bikeway. So I've been riding my bike pretty much every day during this whole pandemic, on the bike path and combination of roads. Anyway, there's a book out called Hearts of Lions by Peter Nye, and it's actually an update of a book he wrote 30 years ago. It's the complete history of American bicycle racing from the very beginning until 2016. He's interviewed over 1,000 cyclists going back all the way to 1908 up until 2016 in the Rio Olympics. So I didn't know any of this stuff, or very little, but American bicycle racing goes back 140 years. And until the 1920s, they drew bigger crowds than any other sporting event, and some of these racers made more money than Ty Cobb or any of those people like
wow.
that. You're introduced to all these characters like Joseph Magnani, who was the lone American racing in Europe in the 30s and 40s, which is the golden age, apparently, of bicycle racing in Europe. And then Major Taylor, who was the first African-American to win a major sports championship. I didn't know anything about him. All the women racers who are now in, like Kristen Armstrong and Evie Stevens, who left her Wall Street job and is now a champion. Then he goes over the whole Lance Armstrong thing. Anyway, it's fascinating. There's just everything. It's complete Hearts of Lions, everything about bicycle racing, American bicycle racing.
You're listening to The Point. It is our monthly book show. We're talking about books on our home bookshelves with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Peter Abrahams. 866-999-4626 if you'd like to share a book with us. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill?
Well, the next book that I have here is brings me back to the pre-pandemic time, if we can think back that far. And before this all hit, all we were thinking about at the Falmouth Public Library was the census, the 2020 census, because it is a really important thing. And we were trying to encourage everybody to fill out forms. And if you have not yet filled out your census form, please do it. You can do it online. And we were preparing that there would be people that didn't have computers that might want to fill it out online. And so we were figuring out how to deal with that. And we had signs all over our building, Census 2020. And then we closed our doors, and that was sort of the end of although we left our Census 2020 signs on the outside of the building for quite some time. And then I probably was from an email from the Boston Athenaeum, which is a library in Boston, and they do a lot of author talks, and normally you have to go there to go to the author talk, but this is another moment where they're not only doing author talks online, they're letting anybody listen to them, and they had Andrew Whitby on, and his book is The Sum of the People, How the Census Has Shaped Nations from the Ancient World to the Modern Age. And he gave this just completely fascinating talk about the history of census way back to the beginning of time, not just the American census, but world censuses everywhere in the world. He was a really engaging speaker. It never occurred to me I would actually purchase the book, but by the time he was done, I was like, oh my gosh, I have to have a copy of this book. And basically, what the book is about is in April 2020, the United States will embark on what has been called the largest piece time mobilization in American history, the decennial population census. It is part of a tradition of counting people that goes back at least three millennia and now spans the globe. In The Sum of the People, data scientist Andrew Whitby traces the remarkable history of the census from ancient China and the Roman Empire through revolutionary America and Nazi-occupied Europe to the steps of the Supreme Court, marvels of democracy, instruments of exclusion, and at worst, tools of tyranny and genocide. Censuses have always profoundly shaped the societies we've built. And he was such a compelling speaker. And census does not necessarily sound like it's going to be a fascinating subject. But it was great. The book is really interesting. He's got this whole section on what's called the Hollerith Electric Tabulating Machine, which was patented back in 1890, I think it was. So we have had trouble with voting since, you know, pretty much at least since 1880, 1890. And he describes the machine. The Atlantic Building Room number 48 was rented to Herman Hollerith, an engineer originally from New York. Inside, he had assembled a strange-looking invention. It was about the size of a writing desk with the tall cabinet stacked at its rear, giving it the overall shape of an upright piano. Its polished oak would not have looked out of place in a 19th-century parlor, but Hollerith's device was more steampunk than salon. The cabinet displayed 40 dials arrayed in four rows and 10 columns. Each dial had 100 subdivisions and two hands like a clock, which together could count up to 10,000. And it goes on and on to talk about how they were using this to get official U.S. Census numbers. So it is a very interesting book, and I have to say my heart goes out to any author whose book has just, you know, shown up on the shelves during this pandemic, right, because it is really hard to get the word out. So yeah. I encourage you to read Some of the People by Andrew Whitby.
We've got a few emails here. Richard writes, your short diversion to audiobooks brings to mind podcasts. I really enjoyed listening to the audio fiction podcast Blackout with Academy Award winner Rami Malek. It's a thrilling suspense story taking place in New Hampshire. The audio production is brilliant. Thank you for that suggestion, Richard. And then we have Anita, who says, a masterpiece of a book worthy of many repeat readings and a Pulitzer Prize winner, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon, published in 2000. And she says, for comfort and inspiration, any and all books by Harold Kushner, author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And then we have another Richard, says, on the last day before the pandemic closure, I raced through the Wellfleet Library, scooping up books for the voyage. He's a captain. I happened upon The Lives of Margaret Fuller, yes, that's plural, by John Madison. We ought to know more about this early Massachusetts intellectual of uniquely American thought. Subsequently, I've learned there's another volume about her by Joseph J. Dice, the late owner of the John Young Newcomb House, made famous by Thoreau's Cape Cod. Thank you, Captain Richard, for that suggestion. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to suggest something for our book list this morning, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Peter, what's on your list next?
Well, one hot topic, or it's certainly going to heat up during the summer as well, is kids going back to school, and not just, you know, young kids, but colleges too, and how they're going to handle it. I hope they all go back. But the book I'm going to recommend now is a novel called The Idiot. It's not Dostoevsky's Idiot. This is Elif Batuman's book called it's a novel called The Idiot by her. And this story takes place in 1995, and it's about a young woman named Celine, daughter of Turkish immigrants, and going into her freshman year at Harvard. So it's a kind of a coming-of-age book, kind of a college book. So it covers her freshman year, and then in that summer she goes to Hungary. She falls in love for the first time and discovers that she's a writer. But anyone who went away to college remembers this little scene, you know, some version of the little scene I'm going to read now, where you first enter your room and meet your roommate. So I'll just read this brief part. Angela had gotten to our three-person, two-bedroom suite at 7 the previous morning and taken the single bedroom, leaving Hannah and me to share the one with bunk beds. When I got there in the evening, I found Hannah storming around in a fury, moving furniture, sneezing, and shouting about Angela. I never even saw her, Hannah yelled from under her desk. She suddenly succeeded in detaching two things she'd been pulling at and banged her head. Ow, she yelled. She crawled out and pointed wrathfully at Angela's desk. These books, they're fake. She seized what looked like a stack of four leather-bound volumes, one with the Holy Bible printed on the spine, shook it under my nose, and slammed it down again. It was a wooden box. What's even in there? She knocked on the Bible. Her last testament? Hannah, please be gentle with other people's property, said a soft voice. And I noticed two small Koreans, evidently Hannah's parents, sitting in the window seat. Angela came in. She had a sweet expression and was black, and was wearing a Harvard windbreaker and a Harvard backpack. Hannah immediately confronted her about the single room. Yeah, Angela said. It's just I got here really early, and I had so many suitcases. I kind of noticed the suitcases, said Hannah. She flung open the door to Angela's room. A yellowed cloth and a garland of cloth roses had been draped over the one tiny window, and in the murk stood four or five human-sized suitcases. I said maybe we could each have the single room for a third of the year, with Angela going first. Angela's mother came in, dragging another suitcase. She stood in the doorway to Angela's room. It is what it is, she said. Hannah's father stood up and took out a camera. First college roommates. That's an important relationship, he said. He took several pictures of Hannah and me, but none of Angela. The Idiot by Elif Bateman, and that's the first day in her dorm.
Okay, wow. All right, let's talk to Richard, who's giving us a call from East Ham. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. I back in the early 70s at Cornell, I was dealing with what was then called IBM cards, but actually their real name is Hollerith cards, just so you all know.
Know that.
Yeah.
That's great.
That makes sense, right?
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
Okay, that's all.
All right, Richard, thanks for that little tidbit. Appreciate
that's
that.
And it's also great because I have to say... reminds me both, well, first of all, both my parents went to Cornell, so it's nice to talk to anybody who was at Cornell, but also when I was in college, I had to take a computer class. I took a computer class at one point, and it is the only class I have ever failed in my life. And now what do I do all day long? I use computers. I teach other people how to use computers. It's just like you can fail a class and still succeed, may I just
still
say.
Succeed. That's right. Janet is giving us a call from West Tisbury. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I've been reading quite a bit. One of the books I finished was Sterling North's Rascal.
Oh, yes.
And the other one I just finished was Mama's Last Hug by Franz Duval. You know about that one? It's fairly new.
No.
Animal.
No. Tell us about it.
What they tell us about ourselves. It's quite a really good book. I suggest anybody to read it.
It's called Mama's Last Hug?
Yes.
Okay. Got it.
The other book that I've been reading, which most people probably won't have on their shelf, is called Robin's Pathologic Basis of Disease. Reading about viruses, and I'm about to start Michael Korda's book called Horse People.
Oh, I'm writing these down. Okay, great. Thank you, Janet. Appreciate that. You got quite a few books going there. Thanks for the call. Annie from Edgartown says, I am reading Homegoing by G-Y-A-S-I is the last name. Great historical novel and a winner of many book awards. A great escape novel for today's times. Annie, thank you for that. And it is, I guess, Peter's up. No, Jill, you're up next.
I'm up. And I have a book for people who can't concentrate on reading, but would love to look at beautiful pictures of people reading. And this is a great collection. It's called Reading Art, Art for Book Lovers, published by Faden. So you know it's a beautiful art book. It is full of both images of people reading and as well as quotations. So, for example, here is one quotation. A book is not harmless merely because no one is consciously offended by it, by T.S. Eliot. And here's another one by Henry David Thoreau. Read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all. I find that looking at images right now, again, is one of those things that I find easier to do than reading whole novels or whole nonfiction books. So this book is pretty, you can see a lot of great images online, but what I like about this one is that you're not on a computer. And I do think that we are all spending probably more time than we normally do on computers for obvious reasons. We're Zooming, we're chatting, we're reading, but just looking at people and their books in these beautiful paintings, I find a huge comfort. And here's one more quote. Just the knowledge that a good book is awaiting one at the end of a long day makes that day happier. That was Kathleen Norris, born in 1947. And the book is Reading Art, Art for Book Lovers. Oh, I should say David Trigg. David Trigg was the one that put this together. I'm sorry. I would not want to be remiss in not mentioning the author's name.
We need that, exactly. All right, Peter.
Well, last month, you may recall on the book show that I brought up the recent biography of Hitler, Volume 1, The Rise of Hitler.
Right.
Peter, how could we forget?
Yes, so no one's going to forget that. So it's kind of an antidote. Today, let's talk about The Rise of Elvis Presley, which is so much happier. So this book is called Last Train to Memphis. It's by Peter Guralnik, and it's about the rise of Elvis Presley. And it's a deeply researched, I mean, incredibly well-researched and very well-written book. And one of the things you won't, so many people, I think, have an image of Elvis, you know, in the latter part of his life, and his really disgusting the way he died, and the horrible hangers-on, and how he was used, and how he lost his self-confidence. But you won't, when you read this book, you won't think of him as a pathetic person at all. It's wonderful how he, his adoration of music and how deeply immersed he was in all forms of it, and how from a very early in his career he really wanted to merge, you know, all these kinds of music. And if you listen to his gospel music, which I have a lot, you see how, and there you can sometimes go back and see the original black versions of these songs and then what he did with them, which was totally respectful, and yet he moved them to some other kind of level. There's a song called Milky White Way, which I recommend to all the listeners. But if I have time, just for this is when he first goes to Sun Records, this very famous moment in the history of American music, which was run by Sam Phillips and in Memphis, and finally, after hanging around there in the lobby for a year, finally he gets a little bit of an audition, and they work on this one song. They worked on the number all afternoon. When it became obvious that for whatever reason, the boy was not going to get it right, maybe Without You wasn't the right song for him, maybe he was just intimidated by the studio, Phillips had him run down just about every song he knew. He wasn't much of a guitar player, but the world didn't need any more virtuosos. What the world needed, Sam Phillips was convinced, was communication. And that's what he sensed in there somewhere, underlying everything in this boy's voice. So, Last Train to Memphis, The Rise of Elvis Presley.
Oh, that sounds like an interesting book. Yeah, I mean, you think about his younger years and you know, he's a really interesting figure, I think. And you're right, we have a tendency to think of his later years.
Really he's a fascinating figure.
Yeah, fascinating guy, yeah.
He had music.
Yeah.
He's a soulful person. I mean, that word is way overused, but he was. Mm. And it's if you go to YouTube and see some of his performances, even where he's dressed ludicrously in the Las Vegas style, some of the performances are still fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. We will have a link to all of the books we talk about this morning at our website, capeandislands.org. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Peter Abrahams, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and books with us this morning. We've got a great list here today, I think.
So, we do. Very robust.
Yeah. Yes. And thanks to all the listeners who shared their thoughts on books as well. I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.